And we move to the last case of this morning, Reed v. Neighborhood Assistance, case number
13-1768. Good morning to the court. My name is Michael Tenaglia, and I represent the appellants, Mr. Reed and Mr. Sears. The first area I'd like to draw this court's attention to today in our appeal from summary judgment is actually it's footnote 5 of the district court's opinion. In that footnote, the court said, plaintiff also raises various arguments as to why NACA's reasons for termination are pretextual. Court then goes on to refer to the Seventh Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit made it very clear that under the stricter Illinois causation standard, plaintiff may not prevail merely by proving that the reasons given by the employer for firing were unworthy of belief. The court goes on to say, even if the court were to consider pretext, and I'd like to draw your attention to that because, quite frankly, the court should consider pretext in this situation. It's true that under the Illinois cause of action, as articulated by the Illinois Supreme Court, the McDonnell-Douglas test, the burden-shifting test, doesn't have anything to do with the proofs. However, it's also true, even though the defendant doesn't have an obligation to explain why there was a termination, if the defendant does do that, the plaintiff has a right, or the employee has a right, to show that that reason is pretextual. The court in that same footnote goes on to discuss the different reasons for termination. But one thing it doesn't do is it doesn't make any reference to the defendant's interrogatory answers, which are completely in opposite to the testimony of the CEO in the case. Mr. Marks, the CEO of the company, claimed in his deposition that Mr. Reed was terminated because he violated the document security policy. He violated practices with respect to submitting the loan paperwork. He had alcohol in his office, and he had certain attendance issues. But if you look at NACA's interrogatory answers, which were never amended, never revised on this particular point, the reason they gave for the termination was there were attendance issues that was going to the Bulls game, and there was an alleged violation of the document security policy. It's also the same thing with respect to Mr. Sears. Mr. Marks testifies that he terminated Mr. Sears because Sears violated the document policy and because he believed Mr. Sears' services to the clients were poor. But again, if you look at the interrogatory answers unequivocally, they say there's one reason for Mr. Sears' termination, and that's violation of that document policy. Those statements in the interrogatories, those are evidentiary admissions, and the court did not consider those at all. And this follows in the idea of the pretext. According to the defendant, their own evidence is that if you look at all the mortgage consultants in that office, with the exception of one, they all violated this document policy, but my clients are the only ones that were terminated. We also have the corroborating testimony of Diana Lazu, who was another mortgage consultant at the place. She says that she wasn't aware of the policy. She said it wasn't enforced, and she testifies that the manager actually kept documents on her table, obviously in violation of this purported policy.
What about the problem that Marks didn't know about the reports of noncompliance with the regs about mortgage applications and then the minimum wage issue and so forth, the whistleblowing activity? He said he didn't know.
Here's that I would suggest to this court would be a problem if it was undisputed that Marks was the decision maker. But there is a genuine issue of fact about whether or not he's a decision maker. Again, the initial, if you go through the timeline of discovery, He's not identified as someone being involved in the 26A1 disclosures. In the initial interrogatories, there's only three people that are identified that are involved in the termination. The Director of Personnel or Human Resources, Kristen Cannonier, Rachel Pride, and Don Meadows. It's only after the depositions of my clients that Mr. Marks, and he took his deposition, but they changed the interrogatory answers to include Mr. Marks as someone involved in the termination, and he also testified, as the court pointed out, he testified that he was the sole decision maker, and he didn't know about any of these complaints. But the admissions and the interrogatory answers still stand as evidence, and they had to be considered by the court. In fact, this court has said that when you don't consider those kind of admissions, it's there. So to address your particular point, there's an issue of fact about whether he was the decision maker, and therefore there's really an issue about fact whether it's even relevant, whether he knew about the complaints or not, because those other people who were decision makers looking at the evidence in most favorable light to my clients, there's other people that made the decision, and those people unequivocally knew about the complaints.
What was the actual interrogatory that you're relying on for this argument? Did it ask who the decision maker was or who was involved in the decision? Because those are two very different things.
Oh, no. I can give you. There's with respect to who was involved.
Because that's a broader, that casts a wider net as opposed to a pinpoint question about who was
involved. I appreciate your distinction, Judge. In interrogatory number two of the February 17, 2012 interrogatory answers, NACA does not identify Bruce Marks as an individual that has knowledge or information relating to the allegations in the complaints.
So it's one of those kind of interrogatories.
That's one.
Anybody who has knowledge or information.
Right.
Okay.
Just real broad. But then it goes on. And then in interrogatories number 11 and 13 of those same, the February interrogatories, the question is who was involved in the termination. And it's a much more focused interrogatory. And the defendant only identifies Mr. Meadows, Rachel Pride, and Kristen Cannonier, the only individuals involved in this decision to terminate the plaintiff. So there's no question, we hit it both ways, knowledge and who was involved in the decision.
Was there any interrogatory that asked who was the decision maker as opposed to who was involved, which can be anything from
inclusive of the decision maker.
Right.
No. I mean, who made the decision? No interrogatory like that. But who was involved in the decision to terminate? I would submit to the court it would be very difficult to say that doesn't include the decision maker if there was only one. We also have conflicting evidence about who made the decision. Cannonier testified in her deposition that it was a group decision. And I'm not going to be able to say exactly what she testified to, but she testified that it was a group decision rather than the decision of one person, a la Mr. Marks. I see that I'm...
That's fine.
Unless there's more questions, I'd like to reserve some time.
That's fine.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Mungerson.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Darren Mungerson. I'm representing the Appellee Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America. Contrary to appellant's assertions, the district court's decision granting summary judgment to NACA should be affirmed in its entirety because appellants failed to establish a genuine issue of material fact with respect to whether they were terminated because of their alleged complaints. Appellant's arguments that the district court failed to properly follow procedures and erred in granting summary judgment to the appellee are based in fallacies, and that's both factual and procedural. As a preliminary matter, under the standard recognized by this court in Gasig versus American Airlines in a claim for wrongful discharge under Illinois law, the burden of proof always remains with the plaintiff. There is no burden-shifting approach, as in the case under the McDonnell-Douglas standard. Instead, under Gasig, appellants, as in a traditional tort claim, must prove that their protected activity was the cause of them being terminated. Additionally, under Gasig, in order to defeat a motion for summary judgment, a plaintiff must do more than simply prove that the reasons given for the termination were unworthy of belief. Instead, the plaintiff must again provide evidence that would prove that the reasons for the termination were, in fact, because of the alleged protected activity. Notably, plaintiffs do not cite Gasick in their briefs, and the vast majority of the cases that they cite in support of their position are cases decided under the burden-shifting McDonnell-Douglas standard. And that's a standard which this court and Gasick recognize results in a lesser burden for plaintiffs. Under the standard recognized by this court in Gasick, it's the appellant's burden to prove all the elements of the retaliatory discharge claim, and that includes causation. They therefore must provide evidence that, if believed by the trier of fact, would demonstrate that their alleged complaints were the reasons, again, why they were terminated. As the district court held, in its well-thought-out opinion, appellants failed to provide any evidence that would demonstrate this, and therefore appellants failed to show any genuine issue of material fact as to causation. Appellants' arguments in support of the appeal are generally fourfold. First, they allege that the district court erred regarding consideration of evidence as to whom the decision-makers were. Second, they allege that the district court erred in discounting evidence of animus. Third, they allege that the district court erred by not finding that the timing was resulted in an inference of retaliatory discharge. And fourth, they allege that the district court erred in discounting appellants' alleged evidence of pretext. However, the district court's opinion makes clear that they did not ignore this issue, that Judge St. Eve didn't ignore this, but actually reviewed them properly in light of the Gasick standard. Their purported issue as to the identity of the decision makers was properly addressed by the district court. It's in the decision. They talk about this issue. And the court found that this was insufficient to raise a genuine issue of material fact with regard to causation. This issue relates to the question of knowledge of the decision makers. And although appellees contended that Bruce Marsh was the decision maker and that he lacked knowledge, and that was undisputed, appellants contended that the record demonstrates that others were involved who allegedly knew of the complaints. The district court took this issue into account and correctly noted that even if the evidence, taken in a light most favorable to the appellants, showed that some, but not all of the decision makers knew about the complaints, and there's no question about Rochelle Pride having any knowledge of any complaints. But even if some of them knew, that was insufficient to demonstrate that the decision was made because of the alleged complaints, and that the appellants needed to show something more than mere knowledge of the complaints to meet their burden to show causation. With regard to appellants' arguments that the district court didn't take evidence of animus into account, this too misstates the record. The only alleged evidence of animus on the part of any of the decision makers consisted of pure speculation on the part of the appellants. They provided no evidence or testimony that any decision maker ever chastised, threatened, or expressed any ill will towards the appellants as a result of any alleged complaints, and the district court properly recognized that this speculation was insufficient, and I'm quoting from the opinion, was insufficient to create a genuine issue of material fact as to whether one of the decision makers had any retaliatory animus based upon plaintiff's complaints or whether any such animus caused their terminations. In raising this issue, they're not asking that the district court view evidence in a light most favorable to them. They're asking that the district court basically take all of their allegations as true, regardless of whether there's any record support. Well, that might be proper in the context of a motion to dismiss. It's not proper for a motion for summary judgment. Simply put, with regard to animus, there was no evidence that was provided that would demonstrate that.
Would the animus be somehow tied to the complaints?
I'm sorry?
Would the animus alleged be tied to complaints?
Well, the animus would result in a question of pretext, whether they have provided any circumstantial evidence.
But I'm talking, because, you know, supposedly everybody was complaining.
That is correct. The record showed that everybody, that there were many more people than besides the appellants who had raised the complaints. And I would like to take this point to recognize that appellants' counsel had argued that only the plaintiffs were terminated. That's actually not true. There was a third individual, Maria Jasinska, who was not alleged to have made any complaints with regard to the type of complaints that were made by the appellants.
Why was she terminated?
She was terminated for violation of the policy. She had violated the policy. And I'd like to take this point to address one issue. Appellants have argued specifically that there was some sort of change in the issue of why the appellants were terminated. That's simply not true. Mr. Marks testified when asked about why these individuals were terminated instead of the others, because it is true that all but one of the mortgage consultants were in violation of the paper policy. Therefore, the reason that these individuals were terminated, the appellants were terminated, were because of that violation. But Mr. Marks testified that he had to make a decision as to who to terminate. If he were to terminate everybody who violated the policy, he would not be able to run the business. So therefore, he looked at additional factors. So it was basically violation of the paper policy, of the paperless policy plus. And Ms. Jasinska was terminated because she had attendance issues. Mr. Reed was terminated because he had attendance issues. There was alcohol found in his office by Ms. Pride, again, someone who's there's been no allegation of animus or even knowledge, and because there were incidents that he was not following up, on certain files. Again, evidence that was testified to by Ms. Pride, who, again, has no evidence of animus. And then Mr. Sears was terminated because of violation of the paperless policy, and Mr. Mark's belief that Mr. Sears had exhibited poor customer service. Those were the reasons why those three people were terminated. So unlike while those people were terminated, while others who had violated the paper policy were not terminated. But it was because of the violation of the paperless policy that these three individuals were terminated. Had they not violated it, they would not have been terminated. And I don't think that that's in dispute. Finally, the next point that I'd like to touch base on is the issue of the quote-unquote suspicious timing. Appellants have alleged that this was an issue that was simply not addressed by the district court, but in fact it was. And the court noted that the record showed that the complaints had gone on 4 months and that there was simply no evidence that the most recent complaints alleged by the plaintiffs were any more special or any more different than any of the complaints that they had been making 4 months prior to the terminations. Instead, what the record showed was that Ms. Pride had showed up at the office, viewed the violations of the paperless policy, and that's what triggered the terminations. On this particular issue, I think it's relevant to point out that the McClendon case cited by the appellants provides a perfect example that suspicious timing alone, even if the suspicious timing is found to exist, does not provide a basis for denying summary judgment. There, although the court found that the timing of the plaintiff's discharge was enough to establish a prima facie case under the McDonnell-Douglas standard, the employer provided a legitimate, non-discriminatory basis for the termination, which the plaintiff could not establish was a lie, and the court granted summary judgment for the defendant. The final point that I'd like to discuss is the issue of pretext. As an initial matter, the appellants are asking this court to treat the procedure for summary judgment on their claims under the McDonnell-Douglas standard, the burden shifting, the prima facie, then the production of a legitimate non-discriminatory reason, and then pretext. As discussed earlier, that's the wrong standard to be utilized, and under the proper standard of Gasek, it's not enough that the plaintiffs show that the reasons are unworthy of belief. They have to provide evidence that the terminations were because of the facts or for the reasons claimed by the plaintiff. In sum, although appellants argue that summary judgment should not have been granted because of the things that they allege the district court failed to do, it's clear that the district court properly granted summary judgment because of the things that appellant failed to do. Appellants failed to meet the required burden under Gasek. They failed to provide any direct evidence of causation. They failed to provide any evidence of animus on behalf of any of the alleged decision makers, even where the district court assumed that the decision makers went beyond Mr. Marks. They failed to provide any evidence that the decision makers did not honestly believe that the proffered reasons for termination, that they did not believe in those. And in conclusion, I would ask that you affirm the district court's decision. Thank you very much.
Mr. Snaglia, you've got 2 minutes left.
Judges, when in the court's opinion, the district court's opinion about timing, the court said, although plaintiffs argue that plaintiffs complained as recently as several weeks and days, respectively, before their terminations, the record demonstrates that most of the complaints regarding minimum wage and overtime came in June and July of 2010, and those concern NACA's practices with respect to splitting commissions and signing Form 1003s from March to June before NACA's decision to terminate plaintiff. I probably mushed it a little bit, but it's on page 21 and 22 of the opinion. But in fact, Mr. Sears, 3 days before there's an email stream complaining about him having to split commissions with someone. So it is, with all due respect, the judge either didn't consider that information or somehow didn't include it. The essence of our argument is the judge did not take consideration of these interrogatory answer admissions. I don't see how she could avoid saying, well, that's evidence that there were only three people involved in this termination, and Mr. Marks isn't one of them under the summary judgment standard of looking at it in a light most favorable to the plaintiffs. I also can't see how the judge could have avoided the conclusion that in a light most favorable to the plaintiffs, there were only two reasons for Mr. Reed's termination and one for Mr. Sears. And I also want to point out on that particular point, Mr. Marks, the CEO, admitted that violating the security policy alone wouldn't have been a sufficient basis for termination. And we point that out in our brief. So while there was this one other person who was also terminated, with that respect to the other person, the defendants admit that it was for two reasons, attendance and violation of the policy. And again, in a light most favorable to the plaintiffs, Sears only had one reason, the security policy, which Mr. Marks concedes wasn't enough. So we, on all that base, that we hope that you will consider and reverse the decision of the district court.
All right. Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. That